He said, "You can't buy the Royal Trust building on a credit card." I had written one building, $65 million. I'd signed it. I said, "Could you please call for an authorization?" And it was a gold Royal Trust credit card. They sent me my bill yesterday, and I paid it, and I brought it up to date. That means I won't get another bill for 30 days. That's worth 1%. 1% is $650,000. And I said, "And by the way, I don't know whether you know it or not, but on a gold Royal Trust credit card, you get a 1% discount." That's $1.3 million. Started from the bottom, now the whole team here. Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team in. Started from the bottom, now we here. Started
so, as long as I have, like, known about, like, the real estate business, and you and I have always been fascinated with the real estate business, there's this one company that always comes up.
Canderel.
And I actually didn't know the story behind Canderel until you started talking to me about Jonathan Weiner.
He's amazing.
And you brought him up to me for years and years. You've been talking about this guy, Jonathan. And I actually knew nothing about him. And so as we began to think about Big Shot and who he wanted, I started to do a little bit of some research on this guy to figure out, okay, is this guy as amazing as Dave thinks he is?
Hit us with the stats. It's unbelievable.
So this guy, in the 1970s, started with a $10,000 loan.
Yeah.
And he's rolled this into, let me get the numbers here.
Billions. Many, many billions.
Sorry. So a $10,000 loan in 1975, he borrowed $10,000 on a $19,000 salary, and he was able to make this purchase. He ended up making $50,000 profit on that first
right, he
property.
Bought a Concordia building and turned it into a restaurant.
Exactly. Concordia, for those that don't know, it's a university here in Montreal. So he bought a little building right by Concordia, and then he used that money to start Canderel, the profit he made. He was 25 years old. Today, they have 60 million square feet of owned, managed, developed properties, and they've done $15 billion, with a B, dollars of acquisitions and developments. I mean, this guy has built the entire landscape of Canada.
Amazing. He's the tallest residential building in Toronto. He's also now the chancellor of a university, huge in the community.
Now, it's not just that he's like this incredible entrepreneur and incredible builder. One of the things that when we started talking to some people and asking them, tell us about Jonathan, the way that he operates is really smart. He's so strategic. So if he wants to work with someone, for example, even if they say no, he always finds a way to bring them in and make it worthwhile for them. He leaves enough on the table so they can benefit. And instead of just convincing them, he kind of shows them, and eventually, in his own Jonathan way, he gets exactly what he wants.
And that's his book, right? No is Maybe on the Road to Yes.
That's what his book's called?
He's about
no
to come
is
out
Maybe
with
on the Way to Yes. I love that. I mean, like, it's so perfect for a Big Shot.
Totally.
So this story is incredible because, one, most people haven't heard, like, if you don't understand real estate, you may not have heard Canderel, but what you will start seeing now that you've heard the name, you will start seeing Canderel signs everywhere.
Yep.
I mean, these guys built Canada.
And
they've done
America,
it in a way that, you know, someone we reached out to says he has such a huge heart, they called him the Jewish Santa Claus.
I love that.
But again, he started with a $10,000 loan and has built a $15 billion real estate empire, and he did it with heart and integrity. I cannot wait to talk to Jonathan.
It's
going to be a great episode. And I think he exemplifies this concept of Big Shot and big, audacious goals.
Jonathan Weiner,
let's go.
Let's go. Started from the bottom,
not a whole team. Jonathan, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Cheers.
So,
I'll kick us off here. You weren't always such a big shot.
I was never a big shot.
Well, we may disagree on that, but David's right. Yeah, take us back to the beginning. I mean, we all know the famous story of the $10,000 starting point of Canderel, but we want to go back before that.
At 16, I went to see Maxwell Cummings. That's Stephen Cummings' grandfather.
Yeah. We know the Cummings Center.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And he was married to Queenie Weiner, which was my grandfather's sister. Okay. And they were building a large portfolio in Calgary. And I said, listen, I'm 16. I'm going into university next year, and I want a job in management.
Right.
He said, tell you what, go buy yourself a pair of hard-toed construction boots and a helmet, and I'm sending you out to Calgary, and you'll learn about management. And I learned to build from the ground up.
You were like the foreman there.
No, I was no foreman.
No foreman.
I was a laborer.
You're a laborer, okay.
Bottom of the totem pole.
Bottom of the totem pole.
Yeah.
By the end of the summer, and they put me through the ringer, and I wouldn't quit. And I could go on for hours on some of the stories that went on in terms of having to carry steel frame exit door frames up 30 stories, and I wasn't allowed to use the crane. And most people would have quit.
Did part of you love it?
I didn't love it.
No.
I just said, nothing's going to break my back.
Right.
End of the summer, I became clerk of the works on the job. And so I moved up quite a peg. I wasn't anymore on the construction site. I was in the office. The next year, they hired me to act as a general contractor for the same building, selling tenant improvement packages to the tenants. And I made $1 million in the 6 months in my first year of university.
You're like 17 years old.
17 years old.
And you're selling them insurance, effectively.
No, I was selling them packages. of tenant improvements that we would turn for them.
Okay.
And we were the general contractor.
Yeah, the
I was running them.
So you basically had a menu of things you could sell them, and you just outright.
Doors, ceilings.
And this is not $1 million today. This is 19.
This is 1968.
Right. Yeah. Wow.
Okay. So I fell in love with the business. I absolutely fell in love.
Was there an aspect of the business?
Yeah, what'd you love about it?
What'd you love about it?
Scale. The size of, I wasn't talking, suit for $16.
Yeah, yeah.
I was talking about $1 million contracts. I was dealing with prominent business people. I was getting deals done. I was just absolutely beyond happy, okay, in terms of intellectual stimulation. I said, this is it for me.
Wow.
So I was lucky. And I consider the lucky people in life the people who can have a passion for what they're doing, not the people who just make money, or the people who unfortunately never find the things that they're passionate about and just follow in a rut for the rest of their lives. That I consider my greatest piece of luck.
Yeah.
The rest followed.
Sure.
And you make your luck by how hard you work and how you put yourself into everything you do. But that gave me a real foundation for the future.
Let's go back a little bit to when you decided you want to spend the summer as management. I mean, that takes a certain level of chutzpah to call and say, I'm going to be management now. Was that something that you always sort of had, you always felt the audacity, the confidence to take something?
Well, wait, before you answer that, what does chutzpah mean to you?
No is maybe on the road to yes.
Which is your book that's coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I believe not taking no for an answer. So figuring it out. I was probably a bit brash and a little very naive at the time.
You're 16. I mean, okay.
Right. Yeah.
Who's not?
I knew that I was going into management at Concordia, which was Sir George at the time. I obviously wanted something that was aligned to that. But if this was a route to get there, and he told me, he said, you hunker down, learn, learn everything. And the amount I learned about construction that summer, and I remember a cement truck driver saying to me, you must be Jewish. I said, why? He said, you ask so many questions. And I was asking about the different aggregates and what's the difference between this concrete and that concrete. And I was learning.
I was learning like a
sponge. And I've always been a sponge for learning from people and or experiences.
So now you're in the office, you're selling. What happens next?
So what happened next is they asked me to quit school and come back.
To Calgary.
Yeah. And there's a lot of interesting little anecdotes within that, because what happened was I wasn't making enough money for my expenses, and I was putting myself through school. My parents did not put me through school.
Wow.
In fact, they made it worse. They charged me rent.
They charged you rent to live at home?
Yeah.
And why is that?
Yeah.
I only found out later it was a forced saving. They gave it back to me when I got married.
But you didn't know at the time?
No.
And so they were trying to create independence, presumably?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They wanted to instill the value of saving? Yeah.
Yeah. They were hard driving. They really did. Sometimes I felt like it was too much.
Right.
Like maybe I should be able to cool my jets or my engines a bit. But I was so hard driven in so many ways. It was always there. Mm-hmm. And I am a passionate guy. I love what I do, whether it's philanthropy or it's community or it's business. And so the engagement's always intense.
Right.
And I don't mean intense in the dealings, intense to get it done, mm-hmm. to get to the finish line.
Right. And then you get to Concordia, which is a, you describe as a part of you, and you meet your wife on the first day.
Her father said, you're only going to university to get married. And she said, no, I'm not. And she met me in the first hour.
Where'd you meet her? How did that happen?
So I was very active at Sir George. I was the first student member of the board of governors. I was chairman of clubs, chairman of a blood drive, skiing, and all kinds of other activities. In my fourth year, I was involved with freshman orientation. There I was wearing a three-piece suit, and this young lady comes, no shoes on.
No shoes?
No shoes. She walked from her home in Saint Laurent, no shoes, to downtown.
Wow.
Hair down to her middle of her back, and stunning. And I gravitated to her table and managed to talk to her.
Well, you're in a three-piece suit. She's not wearing shoes. I mean.
Anyway, she goes to her friend Linda, who's still a good friend of ours, and says, "That's the kind of guy I want." And she played hard to get for a few weeks, a few months. And finally, we had a date. I was president of the student union in that last year. I had renovated that student union. And I was the MC for Pass the Hat.
Wait, what do you mean you renovated the student union?
Okay, so a group of us bought the student union, okay. which is where Villeneuve had his bar.
Yeah. So a group of, like, you were a student and you bought the building?
Yeah.
How old were you?
20.
This is privately or through the school?
Through the school. And my summer job that year, I told you I took a year off from Cummings, that year I renovated it. And it's actually in itself quite a story because I kept going for a building permit and a set of plans. And the first time, these are all part of the Noah's maybe. Mm-hmm. First set of plans, the building permit department said you need to make this, and this, and this change. And I said, okay. So I went back, made the changes, came back, made application for the permit, didn't get it. This happened three times. I'm only 20, but I'm realizing that I'm being held up and right. I'm an institution and
right.
this isn't right. So I go back to the student association floor on the fourth floor at Sir George, and I said, I'm calling the mayor. Oh, yeah, who are you? You're going to call? I'm calling the mayor. So I pick up the phone. I call the mayor's office. And the woman says, I'm sorry, the mayor's busy. I said, well, I kind of knew that that's what you were going to say, but just let me interject a few words here, and then we'll see where this conversation goes. I said, my name's Jonathan Weiner. I'm president of the student union. I don't know whether you realize it or not, but the mayor's running for re-election in October. And this is the first time that students will have the right to vote at 18 years of age. They are going to be furious when they find out that City Hall has been holding up the student union from being able to renovate and be open in September.
That got her attention.
Just a moment, please.
The mayor's not busy all of a sudden.
Mayor gets on the phone. He said, tell me the story, Mr. Weiner. I tell him the story. He said, you come here at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, you'll pick up your permit.
Wow.
And he made the guy hand it to me. He was so red-faced.
Wow.
Chutzpah.
Yeah.
Total chutzpah.
No. It's not a matter of chutzpah. It's a matter of right and wrong. And my attitude is, you have an obligation to execute.
Right. Yes. Okay. But the chutzpah part of it is the fact that you decided you call the mayor directly.
I mean,
whereas most people would never even think to do that. They'd be like, well, I guess that's the way it's done.
Yeah.
I guess we have to wait in line.
I mean, you're 20 years old.
But I also, because of the ethos that I was given by my grandfather, payoffs were just not in the vocabulary.
What was the actual ethos? What was the thing that...
Just a high level of integrity in dealings. I've left millions of dollars on the table for integrity.
Can you give me an example of that?
Well, I have two situations. One is where a large tenant invited me. We were working on their renewal, and he invited me into his premises on a Friday at noontime. And he said to me, and I think at the time I was 29 years old, he said to me, you know, my daughter's getting married very soon. I said, congratulations. I said, I have two daughters myself. He says, you know, weddings are very expensive. Hmm. I said, oh, yes, I'm starting to save now.
You're 29.
2 and 4 yeah. years old. But I understand that weddings can be very expensive. And he goes on and on and on like this. And I said to him, look, and this is an open office landscape environment, but there is nobody else in there except me and him.
Wow.
And he says to me, do you not understand what I'm saying? I said, I understand completely what you're saying. But if you're telling me that the renewal of your space depends on me helping you out with your daughter's wedding, we're not doing business.
Wow.
And this was, at the time, about a $10 million lease.
Wow.
Okay, and $75. And $79.
And you own this building?
I was a part owner.
Yeah.
Not a major owner.
Right, but still,
owner.
Yeah.
And I lost the deal.
Wow.
And I told my guys, my bosses, I said, you know, if you want to overrule me, that's fine, but I will not do it.
And just to be clear, it's a $10 million lease, but he probably didn't need much. He probably needed $25,000, right? Something like that?
Right.
And you still said no.
I don't do it.
You don't do it.
I don't do it. I've never done it. I never have to look over my shoulder.
So, I mean, we got to go back to the start of real estate, where this famous story where you I believe you start first, you leave Concordia and you get a job, right, with Eugene Reisman.
The counsel I got was, you know enough about construction, go into leasing, because that's where the money's made. It's not, the execution is in construction, the value's created in leasing. So I went into leasing, I worked in PVM, and then I moved over to a building called 2020 University, which was a joint venture with First Quebec Corporation and TriZec. I did the leasing there. I gained my first 20 pounds in real estate doing the first fast food fair in the basement of 2020, trying out all the different foods to make sure we had the right package, et cetera, and get it done. Interestingly, so many of the buildings I had connections to, I ultimately bought, because I ended up buying 2020 University 30 years later.
That must feel good.
Yeah. Anyway, I put together a fairly large deal, a 100,000-foot deal, and TriZec said, too small for us, we don't want to do it. I said, you're too big for me, I need to go. And First Quebec was Gene Reisman and Ralph Berman at the time, a very small office. They made me a vice president at 23 years old.
Incredible.
Reisman, who's still alive and who I've looked upon as a father figure. He's a real Renaissance man, a very lovely individual, but not a great businessman. Strategic, but not business execution. And that was a great asset because it was a void that I could fill. And he let me go. And so one deal after another, when I started out with him, and we'll roll back to 1975, but I told him, I said, I'm not really interested in salary. I'm interested in equity.
Yeah.
I want to build wealth.
Was that always how you thought about it?
Yeah.
With jobs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything I did along the way was to get to that point.
Yeah.
Reisman said, you know, you can participate. I'm happy to have you participate in the deals, but you're going to have to write your own checks. Reisman's father used to call me on Fridays to find out what his son was up to and was he doing the right thing or the wrong thing. So I'll roll back to 75 because in 1975, I needed equity to go into a couple of deals. And I had a pregnant wife.
Right.
Pregnant. We had actually 1975 was the birth of my first child. So we had that. We had an apartment on Nuns Island. We were looking at a house. Reisman was giving me an interest-free mortgage to buy a house, so that would really get me going. And I realized I better put together some money. Lo and behold, now Concordia, not Sir George, calls me, the treasurer of the university, and says, John, nobody knows the student union building better than you. You know every screw, nut, and bolt in the place. We've outgrown it. We want to sell it. Would you like to buy it? So I said, sure. I negotiate with him.
But you said, sure. You had
no money. Yeah.
I had $5,000.
You had $5,000. Yeah.
So I had $5,000.
It almost rounds to zero, but yes.
Yeah.
$5,000 in those days was not so bad.
Sure, it's true.
It's funny because when you research the story, it actually rounds up to 10.
No, but then I had to go see Guy Tremblay at the Banque Nationale. It was then the BCN, Banque Canadian Nationale. Mm-hmm. And I figured he was one of my true heroes because earning, I think, $13,000 at the time, I said to him, I need to borrow 10 from the bank.
Did he laugh at you?
No.
Nice.
And he said, well, how are you going to repay it, et cetera? And I showed him, and I said, look, I'm going to be worth a lot more money, but you need to take a chance on me. And so I figured...
What credibility did you have with him?
Showed him my plan and my life plan and whatnot.
Right, but you had never done a deal before.
I'd never done a deal before for my own account.
Yeah,
so I figured he was my real...
So how did you know him? I mean, you must have gone to a bunch of other banks that
No, well, they were a tenant in one of our buildings.
I see. Okay.
So he was the bank manager, and I had a relationship with him. Anyway, so he lent me the 10, and I made my offer, and I executed on the offer. And a good friend of yours, father, Jerry Shiner...
Yeah.
Who's a notary at the time,
the sun, yeah.
Introduced me to a fellow by the name of Maurice Barrero, who was a Moroccan restaurateur and was interested in a location in Montreal. And I met him and we sat down and we worked it through and negotiated a lease. And I started to organize my financing for the takeout. And 2 weeks before closing, Mr. Barrero came to me and he said, look, John, he said, I know we negotiated a lease, I'll live up to it, but I really don't want to be a tenant. I'd like to own the real estate. He had bought some of the Timmins, the old Timmins properties up in Westmount, and had renovated and done very well with them. So he said, I like the location, I'll give you a $50,000 profit. Would you be interested in the deal? I said, well...
So this was a $50,000 profit to sell the building right away?
Yeah. At closing.
At closing.
Yeah. Finished. No lease with a restaurateur. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
That $50,000, we did close. And that $50,000 became the startup capital for Canderel.
But wait, at this point, you're thinking you're raising money to put in equity into Eugene Reisman's deals, right?
But I was going to do it through a vehicle. My vehicle became Canderel.
Wow.
So Canderel started out joint venturing with Reisman in 1, 2, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, eventually 49% positions in the deals. And so actually a bit of the past, my next deal, which was much bigger with Leo Kolber and a number of other investors, which was 5757 Cavendish in Côte Saint-Luc, which a year later was supposed to be the continuation of Jean Talon and the continuation of Cavendish Rue de Saint Laurent. It is now 47 years later. It still hasn't happened.
That's right, yeah.
But I needed to borrow a large sum of money and guarantee it at the bank. I did not have enough net worth statement to do it. And it humbled me tremendously, but I had no choice because I had no family to go to. So I went to see Maxwell Cummings. And I said to
him... The original boss when you were 16 years old.
Right.
And I said to him, could I get you to be a guarantor for my financing? Because I don't have the underlying value to do it. And he said, are you prepared to assign your shares in your company, et cetera, et cetera? I said, yeah. He said, and how long will it be? I said, not more than a year. And he did. And TD Bank became the banker. He insisted on TD Bank. And I got the deal done. And I came back to him. I refinanced it and gave him back his note in 6 months. He said, 6 months? Well, let's go.
You had a whole year.
I said, well, here's what I did. And I did a couple of other deals that made it happen. And so that became, I never had to do that again.
Where did you hit the first one that didn't work?
First one that didn't work?
Yeah.
I have to tell you.
They've all worked?
No. We've had two or three
yeah.
that didn't work. But they happened in the 90s.
And was there a common thread of the ones that did not work?
No.
They were all different?
Different things that I learned. For example, the Forum.
Yeah.
Montreal Forum. We did. We brought in a partner that was supposed to know what they were doing. Simon Property Group from the States.
Yeah, David Simon. Yeah.
And the unfortunate thing that you learn with many Americans is they are arrogant as hell, and that you Canadians, you don't know anything, just move over and...
Let us in.
Right. And this is your backyard. I mean, we're blocks away
right.
from it. Yeah.
So they didn't listen, and they pulled a number of moves that we recommended against, but we weren't a major partner. And that project lost $60 million.
$60 million.
You know. So what did I learn from that?
Yeah.
Entertainment real estate is out. Why? We're in the business of financing other people's covenants in the buildings we build.
Right.
In entertainment real estate, they're using the developer's balance sheet to finance their leases. And so.
What do you mean by that? Go a little deeper on that for people.
Because you were putting so much money into their business.
Yeah.
In TIs and improvements.
Right. Okay.
And
tenant allowance, right? It's when you give the tenant.
But $100 a foot or $150 a foot.
To make it look nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that basically they weren't taking money out of their pocket.
Right. They're not doing the build out.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I became chairman of credit at Laurentian Bank. And I learned a lot of lessons on the way through about, you know, the credit and the quality of the user, because it's not the developer in the end, it's the quality of all those
sure.
leases.
Yeah. Can you talk about how you build such great relationships, particularly when you're at a young age, like 23 years old, and you're asking for a lot of money from these people? How did that happen? Like, what was your strategy there?
I think underlying whatever you do to build trust, you have to have competence. And we had proven competence. And there's the old expression, you're only as good as your last deal, yep. but as long as you have a good track record to point to. And when you look at the fact that we've built over $8 billion and maybe along the way lost $60 or $80 million in real estate, that's not too bad.
No.
I will say there were a couple of deals that we didn't make as much as we thought we would because circumstances changed. But you bring up a good point because to me, the ability to cross the same bridge multiple times was more valuable than how much money we pulled out in any one deal.
Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah. For example, when I built my business, and I'll give you just a brief interlude because it'll transition to the next piece. In 1979, I was so blown away by what had gone on here in Quebec that I had been called. I was 29 years old. I'd been called by all kinds of companies to come be CEO, do all kinds of things. And I'd always said, no, I'm very happy. I'm making good money. And at the time, by 79, I had made $1 million. Okay? And that was very much in my goal before I was 30 that I had made $1 million. But I forgot something. And I only remembered later, and Reisman reminded me that I also had said that I wanted to have my own business by the time I was 30. And that was put away way back and very deep. So at 29, I said to Reisman, I said, I love you like a father, but I'm dying here because I grew like this and I'm growing like this right now. I need out of Quebec. And so I actually went through what looked like a heart attack in Florida. In Florida. I started the morning starting to feel a lot like a bronchial congestion, and I was lying in my bed at 10 o'clock at night talking to my wife. I felt like a horse was sitting on my chest. And she screamed at me, get an ambulance and go to the hospital. So I went to the hospital and they checked me for a heart attack and they said, it's not a heart attack, you're having an anxiety attack. Wow. You must know what's causing it, deal with it, or it will be a heart attack.
Wow.
And I went home and resigned.
Wow, that same day?
The next day.
Right.
And I wrote him a note and I said, when you've had a chance to read this, because I was really emotional about it, let me come and talk to you. So I talked to him and then I opened up and I started getting flown to California and Belzberg in Vancouver.
They want to hire you.
Belzberg was a wonderful story because he flew me out, offered me president of First City Developments, 10% of the action bottom line, $400,000 salary, and I think I was pulling at the time maybe 100. And on and on, he takes me home to have dinner with his wife, drives me back to the hotel and says, I withdraw my offer.
What?
I said, why? He says, I don't think you want to work for anybody.
Wow. And what'd you say?
I said, I think you're right. I went home and opened the door.
Amazing.
What was it about that dinner that he figured it out?
Well, he was just very incisive. He was very incisive and he said, I really feel like you're a guy that wants to do your own thing. And
he knew you were a big shot.
He knew where I was going. And I developed quite a relationship with him following that. Anyway, long story short, I had been working on a deal with IATA for a building on Peel Street. And I had acted as a consultant to Reisman to keep it going because the firm wasn't doing anything with it. And finally, I said to Reisman, I said, your whole company, nobody's filling in for me having left and I'm not coming back. He said, well, why don't we do it as partners? And so we did a 50-50 deal. We only had $50,000 deposit out on the land. And so we kept going forward and I kept moving and working on financing and getting things organized. Long story short, he had a little bit of financial trouble and he said, well, why don't you buy me out? So I said, you know what, Gene? I said, let's go to Zittrich Siblin's office.
Yep.
We'll sit with Herb Siblin.
Who's that?
That's
the accounting firm.
Yep.
Famous, yeah.
They were bought by E&Y.
Okay.
Eventually. And I said, let's sit down and discuss price because I don't want to take advantage. And I said, so Gene, what do you want? He said, I want $1 million for a half interest on a $50,000 deposit.
Sounds rich.
I said, Gene, I tell you what, I'm going to give you $1,000,001. And he looked at me and he said, why? I said, because I don't want you to ever be able to say that I didn't give you more than you asked for.
Wow.
And I did it. Herb Siblin said to me, John, are you out of your mind?
Sure. Yeah.
I knew exactly what I was doing. I was tired of having been through the business, joint venturing with other developers. And when you're joint venturing with other developers, there are many ways to do things. So you're arguing style in a partnership when that's not complementary. It's not complementary, it's competing. Mm-hmm. What's complementary was for me to be able to bring financial money, institutions to the table. So they had the money, I had the know-how, put that together and be able to go do many deals.
Right? Yeah, the Venn diagram overlap is too much. You both have the same skill set. If you bring money, if they bring money and you bring the skill set, you actually form the best partnership.
But that's remarkable. But, I mean, $1,000,001, it's probably worth what?
$50,000.
Or 100, even if you're giving them a premium? I mean.
Right. So what ended up happening, and it goes back to a question you asked me earlier, is I did a deal with North American Life, who put up the $1,000,001 to buy Reisman, so I didn't put out the money. I got the full development fee, which I didn't have to split with him. And I developed a relationship with North American Life, which built my career because I did multiple deals with them.
Wow.
So many that I got to a point where, and I loved the relationship so much, that I had befriended the financial, the CFO of the company. And I told him what I had in mind, that maybe I should sell 50% of the interest in the company to North American and we just keep going forward. Ori Fadani built up a huge portfolio with North American Life. So there was the example. And he said to me, John, don't do it. I said, why? He said, you're going to outgrow us before we outgrow you. You're going to have more deals than we can service. Diversify your relationships. And so what ended up happening, which goes back to your earlier question, I did half a dozen deals with North American Life. I did half a dozen deals with Great West Life. I did 10 deals with Aetna. And they became my partners, and they all had different kinds of deals that fit their mold.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, you know, if this deal came along, I said, well, this one belongs to Aetna, and this one belongs to North American Life because it fits their mold.
Yeah.
And there was no resentment, and lawyers were, you know, amazed they could send me a bill for $1,200 instead of $12,000 or $125,000 because it was the same document.
Over and over again. So that in itself is absolutely amazing. The other thing that I find absolutely amazing is when we walked in here, you showed us a, what we call in my world a deal tombstone, which is after a deal is done, everyone gets something to commemorate it. And the thing you showed me was this three-dimensional chess.
Yeah, talk to us about that.
Well, actually, cool. I have a really interesting story that I want to tie to this, if I may. So. We did some research on this sort of thing, and I've been thinking about, when you said three-dimensional chess, a couple of things clicked for me. One of the people that I spoke to in anticipation of this interview was Steve Kaplan from Reliance Construction. And I said, Steve, tell me some stories of Jonathan, and how do you explain Jonathan, his success, his chutzpah, his audacity, and how he built this incredible company? And he said, well, the thing about Jonathan is this. He's like, you know, a couple of years ago, Jonathan wanted me to come and work on a deal in Toronto with him. And I didn't want to go to Toronto. This is Steve talking. I didn't want to go to Toronto. And, you know, Jonathan kept asking me, and I said, I don't want to go to Toronto. It's not my thing. So Jonathan said, fine, do me a favor. Just come for the dog and pony show. Like, we want to talk to some bankers. Help me come and talk to the bankers about it. And so I go, and Jonathan and I sell these bankers, and they were so impressed. And Jonathan called me and said, great news. We got the deal. We're going to do this. But there's only one issue. They'll only do it if you do it with me. And then he said, and how could I say no? And he said, and I knew that entire time it was always about Jonathan getting me into the deal. That to me is three-dimensional chess. You knew exactly what you were doing. You saw all the different pieces of it. And I just think that is...
There was another piece to it, though.
Tell me.
Yeah.
And Steve will tell you today he's very grateful for me having dragged him to Toronto.
I mean, we know that
it
building.
Ended well. No, isn't that the Aurora building? That's the biggest residential tower
but
in
he,
the country.
He needed to come to Toronto, so he was not so reliant on Montreal. I have done billions of dollars with Steve, and since Sam Aberman died from Divco, because I used to switch deals between the two of them, mm-hmm. I had the same handshake relationship with both of them, and really, literally a handshake. But Steve had all his eggs in Montreal and a bit in Ottawa, and I said, Steve, that market is crying for you. You have such an opportunity in there to be one of the large contractors there. We're getting out of general contracting our own deals. I'm prepared to give you my staff because we don't want to carry them anymore mm-hmm. in between projects because we got smashed with $2 million carry of all the key staff while the project got delayed mm-hmm. in 2008 because of the debacle. Mm-hmm. And I knew Steve would fly.
But why did you want, I mean, that's not your business. It's someone else's business.
Because Steve and I have a trusted relationship that goes back 30 years. If I want to do most of my business in Toronto, don't you want to have your own general contractor there by your side?
Yeah.
And Steve has never screwed me. He runs his business the way I run mine.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we get along so well.
Mm-hmm.
There's huge mutual respect up and down the entire organization. I can tell you a story about Steve that would blow your mind.
Tell me.
we had a project where I brought Steve in as a design build contractor for Bell Canada on Nuns Island. We had to pull that project together, which was $250 million. We had 17 months to do it, and we had to pull together the provincial government, the federal government, the Port Authority, and the City of Montreal, get everybody sitting at the same table with $30 million worth of highway infrastructure. Normally you'd say, well, that's 10 years right there.
Right.
And you'd 17 my attitude months. Has always been, if everybody wants to see something happen, you can put them down to the table and get everybody to work together to make it happen. If somebody in the group doesn't want to make it happen, you can negotiate all day long. They'll drag their heels and it won't get done. We got everybody into the right place where something that might have taken 30 years to happen could happen now.
Well, you brought them all into the same room.
Yeah.
Well, take us to that meeting. How do you, that's a
because they all had the same vision. They didn't know how they were going to get there, but if we brought a 650,000-foot tenant that was going to pay taxes and was going to make the whole economic creation of it happen and work and allow the rest of the island to be built and developed by virtue of it, everybody was a winner.
Yeah.
And everybody saw it. Steve came in. We had a relationship with Bell Canada that was unbelievable. I was called into Centre the year before.
Which is United Way in Quebec.
Hey?
It's like United
Way. Yeah. So I was called in the year before to head up the real estate division of Centre, and it, for me it was a bit going backwards, but I said I'd do it. And I told Daniel Peretz, who was my senior guy from Montreal, I said, you're going to learn, and next year you're doing it. He said, I don't like that stuff. And anyway, lo and behold, Daniel does it the next year. 3 weeks into the job at Centrade, and Michael Sabia knocks on the door and says, how would you guys like to build our headquarters on Nuns Island? Daniel comes to me and says, you know what? I get it. So we move forward on that. Steve Kaplan developed a construction schedule and worked with us together on the designs, excavated out 16 acres in 2 weeks using mining equipment, okay? Built a mountain, took all the soil with the big super shovels and those big trucks with where the wheels are 10 feet high. He was going 24/7, okay? When the steel came in, $2 million over budget because the structural engineer had miscalculated. And I hear about it. And I picked up the phone and I called Steve and I said, Steve, that's not reasonable that you should pick that up. I'll pick it up or I'll split it with you. He said, never you mind. It's mine.
Wow. We got to go back to a story. Because I spoke to your friend Mark, and he goes, you got to tell him to talk about the Royal Trust story.
Okay. That's a fun one. So Royal Trust started with a guy named Tommy Tucker, and we developed a close relationship with them and built a building for them on York, which was the HSBC building. I think HSBC is moving now, but we built that for them. Developed a close relationship, heard all the stories about what was going on in Montreal with the Royal Trust building here and that people were feeling that they were getting building sickness syndrome and they were losing tenants. And I said, Tom, you know, what's going on? You're not managing it properly. Could I buy it? I said, could I buy a half interest? Because I never dreamed they would sell the whole thing. He said, no, you want it? You can buy the whole thing. I went, wow. So we developed a letter of intent, and lo and behold, the deal looks like it's going to happen. But they had been very clear that I was not allowed to discuss the details of this with anybody. Anybody meant including my bankers, because normally it would exclude your bankers.
Sure. How are you going to get the financing, though, if you don't?
Yeah. Exactly. So we get to a point in the deal, and the deal at this point is $60 million. I get dropped. And no reason. And I'm feeling really anxious and very bad about this. And Tom said, John, put your head down. Trust me, this is going to work out okay, but we have to go through. And he didn't give me details. I found out later they had a client that had $100 million on deposit and who made it very clear they were going to yank their deposit if they didn't get a chance of buying the building. And so if you know anything about the multiplier of on capital, that's probably $2 billion worth of capital for for the trust. So later on, things start to open up a bit. They changed the price to $65 million, and I am really annoyed. I get told this, and I digest it, but it doesn't mean much because I don't have control of the building. Mm-hmm. So around March 25th, 1987, I get a phone call. You still want to do the deal? Yes. Are you prepared to do it and sit down and knuckle down and get it done and nobody leaves the table till it's done? I said, well, that's my kind of language.
Yeah.
So, because I used to have a habit at 4 p.m, I would say to all the lawyers in a room, I said, nobody's going home until this is done.
Smart.
Because what's unreasonable at 4 p.m. is very reasonable at 4 a.m.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's great.
Long story short, we sat down Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock in the lawyers' offices. We did not come up for air until Tuesday.
Wow.
We had clothes sent in, meals sent in, showers in the offices, and we got everything done. And they said, well, how are we gonna have you do due diligence without, because if you walk away from this, it's not a good sign in the Montreal market. I said, well, your property management's so bad. Why don't you just give us a property management contract and we'll use that to do our due diligence. But the beauty of that is that when we buy, there'll be an easy transition.
You're already the property manager.
So they said, great, that looks fine. In fact, I even had a broker call me and said, hey, we heard the Japanese are buying the Royal Trust building. I said, oh, shit, I can't believe it. Anyway, sure enough, we end up going to the closing. So we go to the closing. I don't know. Did Sherman tell you this part of the story? Mm-hmm.
No, he wouldn't tell me the story.
He just said ask
he
about
said
the story.
He wouldn't tell me any stories. He said, ask John.
So we go to the closing, and I told everybody on my side, all the champagne's all organized and all the pastries and everything sitting on the side. And we start at 7 o'clock in the morning. I had to organize myself because there was a trade for the money in New York at 11 o'clock. So everything had to be done by then. I was shaking like a leaf thinking that here I am, 37 years old, buying the Royal Trust building for $65 million. Okay, my hands were shaking.
Is this the biggest deal you've done at this point?
For sure.
By far, yeah.
Okay, by a long stretch.
He's 37 years old,
yeah.
Think about that. I mean,
37.
Okay, so I go in and there's a pile of documents all the way down the table. No negotiation to be had, just sign. So we do that for close to 2.5 hours. And the treasurer is there from head office. Says, could I have the envelope, please? Send it across the table.
The check.
And I hear a shriek.
Shriek?
A shriek.
Okay.
What the fuck is this? I said...
You can swear on our show. It's our show. We can do whatever we want.
I said, what's your problem, sir? He says, this is a credit card slip. He said, you can't buy the Royal Trust building on a credit card. I said, you're kidding me? I had written one building, $65 million. I'd signed it.
Yeah.
I said, could you please call for an authorization? And it was a gold Royal Trust credit card. He said to me, you got to be kidding me. You put all these lawyers and everybody here, and you're trying to close this on a Visa card? I said, yes. He said, I said, I have a gold Royal Trust.
What do you get points? What do you mean? You get a Hertz rent a car.
That's a lot of points. Yeah,
I'm buying the Royal Trust building.
So I'm using credit card.
What could be better?
You haven't paid for a flight since.
He said, Cornelison is going to have a shit fit if he finds out. I said, well, I'm really, really sorry. He said, well, what would possess you to do this? I said, I'm glad you asked that. I said, you know what? They sent me my bill yesterday, and I paid it, and I brought it up to date. That means I won't get another bill for 30 days. That's worth 1%. 1% is $650,000. And I said, and by the way, I don't know whether you know it or not, but on a gold Royal Trust credit card, you get a 1% discount. That's $1.3 million. You guys took $5 million out of my pocket. I'm taking $1.3 out of yours. Call for authorization. Well, the guy looked like he was going to have a heart attack.
He has to call someone and say, I need an authorization for $65
million. $65
million
on a credit card.
So I said, and Tom Tucker was in the room, and he knew me well enough to put his hand up to his face and laugh behind, but knew I was having a time of my life with this guy. And I finally said, you know what the difference is between you and me? He says, what's that? I said, I'm a man of my word. Here's the check.
So you just fucked with them. Perfect. Perfect.
That's hilarious.
So invest in your employees in every way that you reasonably can to build your business.
Great.
And the next piece is give it back. Pay it forward. There are so many ways to do it. Get your employees to get involved. The defee, the strength of the defee is it's ours. It's not we're working for the Children's Hospital or the Jewish General Hospital, right, or Centraide or Jewish community this or that. This belongs to us.
As David and I think about building our own companies, we also think about building with purpose and actually building far beyond just making money, but also having an impact. And one of the, I mean, Defi Canderel has been around for a long time. The impact is
33 years.
33 years.
Yeah,
walk us
33
through that story.
Years, and I think this year brings us to close to $24 million.
It's incredible.
It started. We wanted to do a charity run, and we were in the early days thinking Nuns Island, that we would do it from downtown Montreal across the bridge to Nuns Island, and run a race. Lo and behold, 33 years ago, Susan ends up with her first bout of cancer. Like most men, I look at the doctor and say, what can I do to make a difference? How can I fix it?
Yeah, how to fix it, for sure.
And he said, you can't, there's nothing you can do. But he said, the one thing you can do is develop money for research so that other people don't get this disease and that we make advances. And that left a big impression. I went back to the office, and my current CEO, who left us for about 20 years but is back, was part of the initiation of that. And we started it as a fun run. Costumes were part of the whole thing for a good 20 years. And in those days, I guess we were bringing in about $250,000, and it was meant for business. And it was for business to show it had a heart.
Yeah.
And that cancer really affected a lot of families.
Right.
And there was an opportunity to do something good. We split it between McGill and University of Montreal, 50-50, to their respective cancer research centers. And I have to say, I mean, this year we'll write a check for $1 million to each of them.
It's amazing. One of your friend says Jonathan works 100 hours a week and 40 of them are for community.
That's about right.
Yeah. What other community projects are you most proud of?
MATA, Federation, CJA. I just finished a great run. I was given a $100 million goal with Mitch Garber. And it was to be a 2-year campaign, special during COVID. And we did it, we finished it, the 2-year campaign in 6 months.
Wow.
We had a month and a half of extra work the following year to close that year off, and we brought it to $131 million.
Jonathan, you know, Big Shot is really about, it's an archive. It's about taking these wonderful stories from these incredible people like yourself.
By the way, this credit card story is up there.
It's the best one we've heard yet.
These amazing stories
amazing.
With these incredible entrepreneurs. Amazing. That's definitely up there.
It's amazing. But, you know, we want to, the problem with these stories is they're ephemeral. And they've inspired Harley and I. They've inspired a whole generation of entrepreneurs. And we want to capture them. And if somebody, in many ways, this is a time capsule. And so if somebody picks up this recording 100 years from now and hears this, what do you want them to take away? What do you want? What's that message that you want them, the lessons that you've learned?
I say it in my speech at graduation. First and foremost, be passionate about what you're doing. Don't worry so much about the money. The money will follow if you're really, truly passionate about it. And if it doesn't, you'll find something else. But be really passionate about what you're doing so that it's not going to work, it's going to play. You know, my kids said, "Dad, at 60, when are you going to retire?" I said, "I did 20 years ago." They said, "What are you talking about? You still work like a dog." I said, "I play like a dog." Because for me, every day was a joy and still is a joy. Even though I'm removed from CEO, I'm now COO. You know what COO is? Chief Opinion Officer.
Sure, CEO loves that. Yeah.
But I love the business. And so I love business, not just my real estate business. Right. I love business and many different things that we've done. And I love watching other people's success and making them successful, if I can. So first, passion. Second, put the right people around you and share with them. Let them become wealthy with you. When I built my company giving 20%, not of the company, but 20% of the action in the buildings and the real estate deals, deal by deal, 10% to head office and 10% to the field office. So each city was a field office, 10% went to that city, and 10% went to the head office guys who supported them. Invest in your employees, invest in the organization, and make them, create a family, create, you know, I can tell you, I invited all my employees up to my country home every year for an extravagant dinner and a wild day in the country. We did crazy things, dragon boating, sand sculptures, all kinds of stuff that was team building oriented. My wife used to say, "God, when are you going to stop this?" I said, "I'm never going to stop it because it's part of the employees understanding that I care."
Yeah.
So invest in your employees in every way that you reasonably can to build your business.
Great.
And the next piece is give it back, pay it forward. So I think that's a full life. What's a rich life? A rich life to me is not how much money you have. It's how you feel in your soul. And if you feel good in that, if you can look yourself in the mirror and say, have I done good deeds? Am I doing the right things? If I'm worth $100 million less or $100 million more, it's not going to change my life, but it will change other people's. And, you know, I'm trying. The other thing I would say, and I've done it and I'm executing on it now, and I would say to you, it's the best advice I could give other people. I'm the executor of my own will in my lifetime. And that's a joy.
Yeah. Didn't you have a professor at Concordia that said, don't invest in machines, invest in people? Yeah.
It's machines depreciate, people appreciate, invest in people.
Right.
That's my underlying theme.
I think that deserves a toast.
Okay, I'm for that.
Cheers. L'chaim. Thank you for sitting down with us. This
my
has
pleasure.
Been so much fun.
Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now